I get people to like understand better that sometimes soldiers make huge mistakes because they're kids, and they're kids from really difficult backgrounds. Rather than like idolizing the idea of war, we should examine the cost of it more. Flop out of this aircraft and get in entanglements. Yeah, and I landed with probably about half, maybe a third of my parachute.
Welcome to another episode of the Combat Fuel Podcast. Today, we are joined by a long-term friend of the brand, long-term personal friend of mine as well, Jimmy Elliott, former 7RHA soldier, transitioned now to what I can describe as, it's pretty inspirational, you know? He goes out of his way to help the guys and girls from the armed forces community to look after their mental health. And he's now set up his own practice on Harley Street in London. And, you know, we'll get into it, but he does a lot more than just the armed forces community. Jimmy,
hello.
Thank you for your service.
Thanks so much, man.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a little introduction about yourself.
Yeah, so that was really lovely. So yeah, I'm a psychotherapist and I coach loads of resilience. So I'm a psychotherapist, and effectively what's slightly different about my practice is I combine therapeutic approaches, looking into the past, understanding who we are and why we do the things that we do. But I combine that with the idea of coaching, which is about setting goals and helping people move forward. So I have this kind of psychotherapeutic resilience-based brand. And yeah, I work on Harley Street. So I was kind of recruited into the Serena Clinic by this guy who's this amazing doctor. He's like the second from the top of the European Center of Preventative Medicine. So looking at lifestyle, rather than sort of reacting to poor health, we do like preventative things to poor health. So lifestyle, exercise, food, nutrition, mental health, all of those play huge roles in the prevention of chronic illness and the extension of longevity. And so working with him, and he pulled me on, had this amazing time with him. And I did my master's. So I went and did a master of science in the field of war and psychiatry. And actually last week I was back at King's School, 2 years having graduated from that, actually presenting to them about the project that I'm currently on, which is helping veterans transition out of prison. So working with probation and prison staff to effectively help them understand the needs of veterans and how we can help them transition out. I still have my one-to-one private practice. I'll take the referral still from Harley Street. And I still, you know, if someone's a veteran and they want to reach out, and I take those guys on board and girls on board and support them one-to-one. But yeah, I got involved on loads of these like really fascinating projects. Worked with a Paralympic rowing team, and they all went and got like gold medals, which like screwed the nut for me massively. It's like if you took someone for like 6 weeks to get them fit for a mile and a half and they piled in immediately. They didn't do that. They all ran like a sub-7, which was great. So it made me look really good. I worked with the Paralympians. That was just amazing. I ran a resilience training program for like Police Scotland, which was like really interesting, right? So the thing that was so interesting about working with Police Scotland was you could have somebody who worked in like armed response in Clydesbank. So like East End of Glasgow, really rough. Do you know what I mean? Got spat at by an 11-year-old that morning. Do you know what I mean? Something like that. But you could also then have someone on there who was like worked in like the Outer Hebrides, who hadn't seen a human being in like 3 weeks, and like they had just fixed a fence. So you then had to find a way to like appeal to everyone that was in that presentation about how to develop resilience without one person being like, I feel too alienated from this. I don't get it. Yeah. And the other person being like, this is too almost like soft approach for me. Wow. So it was really interesting. So that, and I've just got like loads of these projects that I've got to go work on and get involved with and help facilitate. Yeah, mate. So that's what I do.
That's brilliant.
And it's cool.
But obviously it's pretty commendable what you do now. Life didn't start off this positive, if we can say that. And, you know, tell us a little bit about your childhood. You know, Your mum left when you were young. Your dad ended up in prison.
Yeah. So, I mean, like the vast majority of people who joined the army, like in our era, so like the Herrick era of recruits, right? The army was very deliberately recruiting from a low socioeconomic demographic because, and I present about this and I've written about this, but like lots of us come from these really broken backgrounds. We come from these broken backgrounds because, not because kids from poor, abusive childhoods are more resilient, but actually because we're actually really vulnerable. And we're easy to radicalize. And that is the truth. Yep. You make great soldiers, like great soldiers, right? But that, and I was one of those kids. So yeah, my dad was a drug dealer and really violent and a rapist. And here I am. And my mum left him and her and my sister left. And I was there on my own with him. He was a drug dealer. Well, he would smuggle it in. So he would use the guise of a chocolate company to bring it over from mainland Europe. And he would then take it to these hotels and distribute it to these hotels. Most hotels, most of these top end hotels, they don't like having drug dealers come in. So they would rather have their own supply there. That's how it works. And so he would supply them. And yeah, so I was with this guy and he was just a monster. You know, like he would just go on these cocaine fueled rages and alcohol, and that was it. Like I was a child, and you had to learn how to navigate that, how to fight, how to escape, how to run away. And that's like childhood. And when you have a childhood that's marred with like that level of violence and that level of abuse, like it fundamentally changes who you are as an adult, and it fundamentally changes the way that you perceive the world. It's probably the vast majority of your listeners are listening to this and going, yeah, like, of course it does. But like, you know, if you have so your primary and secondary caregivers, which like stereotypically speaking is your mum and your dad, right? They're supposed to teach you about safety and love, and like how you perceive yourself is by how they perceive you. So if you grow up in an environment where your primary and secondary caregivers love and adore you and make you feel safe and loved, then you're going to grow up thinking that the world is a safe place. You're more likely to perform well. You're more likely to reach your full potential. You're more likely to get into a meaningful relationship. You're more likely to get meaningful work. You're less likely to find yourself with chronic health conditions, all of this stuff. Like, your life outcomes become 10 times better if you come from a childhood of love and safety. But when you grow up in an environment without love and safety, you know, like we used to go to back, you know, in the 90s when Man United would play like Blackburn Rovers and Coventry City, you know, like industrial towns, we'd go there and like he'd have these fights, you know, like Football Factory was a documentary for me. Like that was normalized behavior. And so there was all of this violence and anger and abuse. He went to prison eventually, and I lived full-time then with my mum. I started going to this school. So in year seven was when the court case started, and by the time I was 13, he was in prison. So I was living with my mum. And yeah, like school was just pandemonium for me. Like inevitably, like as most kids, and you go from one environment where the parent is volatile, explosive and violent, and you go into another one where that person is obviously severely traumatized from her experiences with that kind of guy, and her experiences from her childhood. And then that inevitably then comes out in the way that they parent, or the way that importantly they can't parent. And you know, a lot of therapy is based on understanding why they couldn't parent, because when a child, as human beings really in general, but particularly as children, we don't understand why people behave the way that they do. So we internalize it. So if your dad is of a violent, physically abusive person, and your mum is emotionally not in the room, and then extremely volatile and violent, you will inherently believe that that is because of you. Now, as adults, like we can now appreciate, having gone through therapy and learning the lessons of life, that actually someone is behaving like that's because of them, right? Da, 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 da. But like as a child, you don't have that narrative. As a child, you just have, well, then it's because I am that piece
of
shit.
Problem.
Yeah, I am the problem, right? Right. There's this great line. It's not mine. I can't remember where it's from, but someone said, a child who wasn't spoon-fed love had to learn to lick it off of knives. So then that then correlates to then what you accept and what you date and what you love and what you do as an adult, right? So we're not just talking about like the neurobiological effects. So things like a much heightened stress response and the ability to like really perceive other people's behaviors. I always think it's really obvious when someone has come from an abusive childhood, because you can spot abusers in a room. You can be like, I don't like that person. I don't necessarily have a rational reason for it, but I can tell you they're a bad guy, right? And then however long later, and it always comes out, it turns out that you were right.
Yeah.
It's like, I told you they were the bad guy. And you're like, wow, yeah. But people don't always necessarily pick up on that. But you do, because you grow up in an environment whereby you had to constantly assess where threat is and where danger is. And so there's actually like tiny micro behaviors that are triggering these responses within your brain. And so hypervigilance of people's behaviors, stuff like hypersensitivity, the amygdala, which is like your stress response. So sometimes someone gets put under pressure and they have this like really explosive reaction, and like it doesn't really make any sense, but it doesn't make any sense because you're just seeing that one thing in isolation out of context. When you understand that person grew up in a really violent environment, that kind of behavior makes a lot of sense. I wonder how many young soldiers have lost their careers or been labeled as like bottom third piece of shit guys, when actually if we just zoomed out and took a bigger look at their life, the fact that every time they drink they're a hand grenade probably makes a lot of sense when you understand that their parents were alcoholics who used to abuse them. So like the ability to then understand that, and that then like very much shaped my life. So like school was just like absolute pandemonium. I basically kept going to like science because I was sat next to like the pretty girl in my year and was told to sit in it, and she was just pretty and I couldn't gob off anymore. And the real nice end to that story is that I actually married her like 2 months ago. But so I would go to school and it'd just be absolute pandemonium. Like I remember getting picked up by police like 5 or 6 times. Police would like collect me because I'd gone missing and nobody at that point was going, like, what's going on in this child's life? Like, why do we as the local police know him by name? Because you just get labeled as a bad child. Because like the language didn't exist and no one was zooming out and going, what's going on at home?
Could that arguably be there's not enough resources to look at the wider picture? It's black and white. You've been naughty. You're naughty. Done.
Yeah, for sure.
This is a punishment.
For sure. I mean, there's that great line, isn't there, from just bouncing off of that from Hot Fuzz, where he says, like, there's so much more to policing than knowing the rules. Although this little notepad has solved more crime than anything. Because he just starts jotting things down and people panic and da-da-da. The point is like being like really emotionally intelligent as a police officer probably helps you solve a lot more crime than it looks like. How many people do something in self-defense but then get arrested for that? You know, and we see these like miscarriages of justice because the bigger picture isn't observed, right? Look at like, say for example, soldier, like I'm working at the moment on this, helping veterans transition out of prison program. And so one of the things that I do is I break the day down into pre-service, service, post-service exposures. Do it, it's almost like, imagine like a Venn diagram. And in the middle of that is this individual who's in prison. But if you can understand that we've recruited somebody from a low socioeconomic demographic, which increases their likelihood to traumatic exposures by like up to 5 times. So it's just chronically stressful growing up. They're likely to have a really poor education because it's hard to give a shit about something like Pythagoras' theorem if you don't know if you have a sober parent or not at home.
Yeah.
And so like a lot of these guys who get failed by this education system, they're not failing the education system because they're unintelligent. They're failing the education system because they're so stressed because of home life. So that, and then they've got like violence and trauma. So like hyperreactivity of their amygdala is something that we observe. So like a hyper stress response. So then that's just pre-service. So then I fall into that category. You know, I left school and then left home and then like in and out of like homelessness, supported living, building sites, just doing what you could and joined the army.
And so you joined 7RHA.
Yeah.
Why them? Every unit you could
absolutely
have picked.
No idea. Didn't know, but like same as like every guy, I think you just go in, you have no idea. I had no research. I'd seen a bit of Sharp, if that counts, bit of Sean Bean, a bit of that. But like you go and do the Barb test. I don't think they call it that anymore, but the clicky test.
Yeah.
You know, but that is like, we all joke about that, right? But that is actually an interesting social reflection of the standard of education. I'm not saying standard of intelligence there. I'm saying standard of education. So the standard of it. So like Paul has £2.50 and Mike has £3. Who has more money? Like to us, that's like a ridiculous question. But actually that's a reflection of the standard of education because people don't get in the army because of the Barb test. That's like well worthy to point out. So that, and then depending upon where you score on that, depends on where it is they like to send you. They sit you down and have an interview. Like I didn't know anything. Like I was like sold this and sold that and I had no idea. When I went to basic training, no idea. I didn't know anything about anything or anyone at all. I just didn't know anything. Yeah. Had I known what I know now, I mean, part of me goes, just go and just try and find like the alleyest job imaginable. The other part of me goes, probably just go and get a trade. Like something engineering, maybe like even like air corps and just like push for like a really niche electrical engineering job. Part of me goes, go and join the Navy and go do like maritime engineering and then leave the Navy after 8 years and have like a mega pay job, like living a dream, right? But I didn't know anything about that. I just didn't know. The idea of P Company really appealed to me. So like this idea, there's this course that you can go and do and it's to join the British Airborne and it's all of like the narrative that gets fed to you as a young lad. Like it's the absolute tits. It will literally make you better than everybody else for the rest of your life. Okay, it's like a fitness course. Do you know what I mean? But that's the narrative that when you're a young lad and you're vulnerable and you're from an abusive home, you're very susceptible to that language and it makes you a very good soldier. Like the airborne forces thrive, infantry thrive, special forces thrive off of these kind of guys, right? Yeah. It's really important. I don't think it's a bad thing that we recruit these guys because what you do in that is you offer them the opportunity for social mobility. My main criticism of the army, and one of them is that it's not a meritocracy, and we'll come back to that. But like the other one is that we don't enable social mobility enough. So if you come from poverty and you go and do 4 to 8 years in the military, combat unit, whatever, and you leave there, if you have not seriously upskilled in that time, you are just returning to that poverty. But you have probably far more stresses and traumas in your life now than when you originally left. So actually, you're not in a better place. You're in a much worse one. And that's where, so that's where then, like, we then get these guys who then find themselves in prison. So I always try and increase the picture, because the more you can understand the reason why something happens, the easier it will become to negate it. So I joined 2006, and yeah, I did my, I did 14 years. I got your little veteran certificate thing. Yeah. I got my little veteran certificate thing. But because when I left, I went over to the reserves, because I was a parachute instructor in PTI. And so the parachute instructor thing was like, it was quite cool at the time. Cool. You know what I mean? Like, it was unusual. Yeah. And it was a really handy thing to have, like, units wanted that. So 4Power asked me to come over and do that. So I did some time with 4Power. I did like a couple of years, like 18 months, 2 years. And I helped with like recruit training and did a bit of like para training with them, which I really enjoyed. I think the reserves should actually play like a bigger role in your transition. I think you should go part-time in the regulars and still report to your local reservist unit and do part-time civvy work as you transition out.
Yeah.
I think that should be like a 2-year process. But anyway, I really enjoyed that with 4Power. Like I really did, but it just got to a point with work where what they were asking for was a little bit more than what I could actually physically give. Yeah. Like I just didn't have the time for that. So I got my little thing and I'm like, I wouldn't really necessarily class that as when I left, but I probably can't before then. I did 14 years, mate. And you know, I had a great career. Like I enjoyed it. I was never massively asked about promotion, which I think there's two things. First and foremost, it means you can go and try things like selection. It means you can go on sporting teams. It means you can go and get jobs that you want to do. You can do things that you want to do. It also kind of removes the army's carrot though. So the military relies on the fact that you want to promote to motivate and manipulate behavior. If you're like, I'm not really asked about that, it kind of like takes that carrot away. They're like, it's almost like they don't really know. Like I, being in the sergeant's mess never really appealed to me. In what I did in 7, I was in the FSTs, OPs for like the older guys. But there's like one sergeant who like basically runs the admin for all of the guys in the full screws and the OPs, right? And he sits at that computer and his face just melts off. It's the same as like when guys become platoon sergeants. And they're like, I love being a section commander. I hate being a platoon sergeant because of the admin. So I would look at that and I go, but then why would I want to do that?
Yeah.
Like that's horrendous, that job. Like, and I saw, I think like 5 on the bounce guys just crumble from it because it's just horrendous, right? So then that didn't appeal to me. So I did my 14 years and I did Herrick. And like my Herrick is as full of tragedy as I think like lots of people's are. And I think like it's a very difficult conversation for a lot of us still a very difficult conversation for me. And I have lots of therapy still and have gone through like full-time therapy at one point talking about this. I think the best way to just explain it is that it just fucking sucks. The whole thing was for nothing. But it was for nothing. The whole thing was, it was right. It's hard to look back at it and go, there were so many wonderful men doing so many, and women, I'm so sorry, doing so many men and women doing so many incredible, brave and wonderful acts of heroism, and the camaraderie and the love was incredible. But ultimately we were there for the wrong reasons. Ultimately we were there for the wrong reasons, right? We were part of the bad guys.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it was a lot of Afghan was who's going to be the greater evil? The Taliban who are going to, and they are going to rape your children. They're going to kill your family. What do we have to offer? Oh, we might build you a school. I think in the early Herrick, we won't get too much onto it so we don't get cancelled. But, you know, we were equally the bad guys, you know, as NATO. We had to, Allied forces did bad stuff because you had to be the greater of two evils before you could get there because what's worse. And ultimately, like you said, at one point though, the country and the civilian populace were better off with us there, but it was for a window that was like that. It was such a small window to then, as you said, now for what?
Yeah.
You know, the loss of life, civilian and allied forces for what?
How do we justify it?
And the friends that we continue to lose now for replacing the Taliban with the Taliban.
Yeah, yeah. With a better armed Taliban.
Yeah, with all of our money and our kit and equipment.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yes. So how do you then justify that? And then how do you then take what do we now do, right? So we've got a generation of young men and women who were recruited, very specifically recruited, to go and fight in that war. And ultimately, we lost that war and we were there for the wrong reasons. And now we see the Taliban driving around in our Huskies.
Yeah.
Like holding, when you see the finger over the trigger guard, you're like, they learned that from us. And then how do you then justify that? Because now we get what we identify as moral injury. So people just basically so devastated, you witness something that goes against your sense of right and wrong so much that it creates a hideous psychological abnormality. And so we're seeing this massive rise in moral injury. What do we do with these people? What do you do? How do you support these people? Like, it's not like the government's going to say, do you know what? Like, we did that for the bad. We're the bad guys. You know, if we're saying that, and I completely agree with the argument, but like, the Taliban are the bad guys, and you know, like, they're raping and murdering children. Look in the news today. Like, so are we.
Yep. So, and like, it's maybe a little bit controversial, but nobody's the victim in their own story.
Yeah.
Sorry, nobody's the criminal in their own story. Yeah, So.
Yeah.
And we could debate it forever. Who the bad guys really are? And okay, like, the Taliban commit atrocities in their country.
100%.
Could we also then argue that that's their country, their way of life, and there was no immediate threat to the West? So
yeah, I mean, it's a really difficult conversation when you say to veterans, okay, explain to me why we were there.
And it's, I think the majority of guys, myself included, was we went there to experience war. I think a lot of guys went there because, you know,
adventure.
It's going to be so rare that we're ever going to have. I mean, and the war fighting was, you know, I said it over and over, it's the hardest war fighting since World War II. Mm-hmm. And a very small percentage of people have been able to experience that. And I think every single person said war is hell. Everybody wishes for it until they've done it.
Yeah, there's the one thing you need to be wary of a young man who goes looking for blood is that he'll find it.
Yeah.
And it's that, when I did the talk the other day at King's, one of these students said, oh, she was actually from Ukraine, really interesting girl. And she was saying, oh, my boyfriend he's just leaving the army. He joined in 2021 and he really wants us to go live in Ukraine. And I was like, she was like, but he's obviously been in the army, so he knows what he's doing. And I'm like, I think that that's potentially a big misconception.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Uneducated without the full facts.
But like, you know, how do you say, like, your boyfriend's looking for an answer, when he finds that answer, he's going to really regret doing that? How do you say that without sounding really patronizing?
Yeah.
You know, you just go, okay, cool. And like, am I like tiny, tiny experience of that? And, you know, it's not like, you know, some of these guys I work with, you know, and mental health support, some of them got like the most awful stories, and then you know, they're just deployment after deployment after deployment after deployment. I wasn't necessarily one of those guys, but you just hear these stories and you think, wow, we still glorify war. Like, we still make out like that violence is ever a good idea. Like, invading another country is ever a good idea.
And let's touch on your background and your knowledge with us now. Why do we want it? Because, you know, the films are never made about the mechanics,
right? Yeah.
Fixing a track. War films are war films, you know.
Right, yeah.
And I think the vast majority of us that have served still thoroughly enjoy them, you know. And there's a lot of like...
So I think there's a lot of... Okay, so first of all, see, look, we are raised from a very young age to idolise military service in a way that sometimes we should, but also I think that, like, say, for example, Remembrance, I think is a great example of where we look at the cost of war. That should actually be the focus all of the time. Like, rather than like... idolizing the idea of war, we should examine the cost of it more, because there's very, 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 like, as in a tiny percentage of people who have been to war who then come back from that and glamorize it. So that should tell you everything that you need to know. But like, thing is like, as human beings, we love stories of heroism. Like, we have gathered round fires for millennia to listen to people tell stories and paint things on wall and talk about death and excitement and adventure and love. Like, these are all stories that we all relate to and we all love, and like, they're great. Don't get me wrong, like, Predator is one of the greatest movies ever made.
Yeah.
100%. like is there anything better than Pizza and Predator?
Literally
unbelievable. It's my wedding day and it's an evening watching watching Predator. Like it's that close. But the point is that like these stories, we love stories of heroism, right? But we don't do enough examining the cost of that. And then particularly like how we've become a society with like the average attention span now is 6 seconds, right? And they're attributing that to TikTok. So we don't want like complicated and nuanced layers of information around like the psychological and economic effects and the long lasting effects that has on things like child abuse and parents who can't be in the room as everybody else emotionally because they've disassociated so hard because of the horrors that they've seen are probably going to really struggle to connect with their children. So the children are going to grow up really avoidant, feeling really rejected. And that's just going to perpetuate that cycle of abuse. We don't have time now. People, we do, but people feel like they don't have time now to really explore that. What we want to see is we want to see helicopters explode. And don't get me wrong, I love a big explosion as much as everyone else, but like the glorifying of war becomes a problem. And we see this like time and time and time again. And it's children, we then feed this to them. And like, there's lots of positive aspects of the military, like hashtag this is belonging is actually a really powerful recruitment tool because there's lots of young people pushed out of society who feel like they didn't engage with the education system, who feel chronically let down by the powers that exist and don't help them. And those people should be the people that we're targeting and saying, listen, come here because we will educate you. You'll play a role serving your country, but you'll leave with a better education. You'll leave financially much better off. Like, we will support you and look after you. And that is actually what happens for quite a lot of people. However, there is also people that we know, the kind of like our circle of people who might leave and actually be far worse off. And that's basically where I live. That's where I explore to support and help those people. So the glorifying of war in some ways could be seen as a positive because it helps with recruitment, and recruitment is a great way to encourage social mobility. We take people from low socioeconomic demographics, we educate them, give them even like sense of like moral guidance. Like, what's right and what's wrong is something that most people have never really explored. But when you belong to something like a cap badge, when you belong to something like a beret or a unit or whatever it might be, all of a sudden, the socially normative behaviors are behaviors that are going to further that beret, that cap badge, that whatever, right? Like, you want to do things that are airborne. You want to do things that support the Vikings or the poachers, or you want to do things that support your battery, or you want to do things that support your squadron. Like, so all of a sudden, you're giving someone a reason to behave with morality. You're giving someone a reason to care and support and love something greater than themselves and to put something ahead of themselves, which is a beautiful and important thing that lots of young men learn, that sense of morality. And it's really important that we instigate a good sense of morality within service, because then those guys leave and that's something that they've got, right? I know it sounds ridiculous, but like, army values and standards are actually really important things to carry with you on Civvy Street. Like, we did the Miss Rolls. I know there's like all different variations: courage, discipline, respect, integrity, loyalty, and selfless commitment. I know that sounds really boring and everyone's like, what a Barlow, but actually those things are really important to take with you on Civvy Street. They are actually good things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's good to be disciplined. It's good to have integrity. It's good to be loyal. Like, these are good things to have. And you take that with you and you maintain that. Good. But there are also people who fall out of that system. And that's where, like, particularly the transition phase comes in. How many people, when they left, were happy with how they left, the nature they left, the relationship they had with their unit when they left?
Yep. I wasn't happy at all, you know, very much. We'll come back to this on the career, CTW, the career transition workshop. Awful.
What did you do? Did you do the how to write a CV one, like three days?
And yeah. Don't swear because you'll never get a job. Like, fuck you, tell me what I do. What have you done with your life? You're sat here teaching a class of how to do it. What have you done?
They stuck us on indeed.com for an afternoon. So we had to apply for jobs on indeed.com.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow. Yeah, that was really helpful for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How much of your financial support did you get? Did you get any of your learning credits, anything like that?
I was really lucky in a way. I did. I managed to redo. So I already had my personal training qualification. I got to redo that. For my enhanced learning credits. But that was only because I had a really, really good senior NCO be like, you know, you've got all this money that you can use for courses. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Can you just pay it to me and I'll sort it out? They're like, no, because you told us you won't. So this is everything you've got available. I'm like, wow, I can do all these courses and it's free.
Yeah.
Like, well, it's not free, but you know, the military will pay for them as part of your resettlement. And, you know, and I grabbed it by the horns, and I was very, very lucky. I had a small amount of money paid by SAFA, and they gave £500 so I could do a further course for adapting, to do my personal training, my adapting exercise for older adults, exercise prescription for anti and postnatal women.
Nice.
and a level 4 obesity and diabetes. So, you know, but that was, they didn't tell me any of that.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
That was a guy at unit that was like, go and use it. And you can have, I think it's about £1,000 a year for the next few years after you've left to continue doing your own development on certain courses that the Army have approved, which...
That's great.
You know, and how many people don't get told that? I didn't get told that on my resettlement.
So I did my Master of Science in War and Psychiatry, and the MOD now will take research from King's. They don't fund like all of my stuff, all of my counselling courses, everything I've had to pay for. Like I had student debt. I've still got a student debt. Like you have that's the reality for like lots of people. Yeah. That whole thing is like it lets people down. So I think that let's look at the infrastructural issues first and foremostly. Career transition just doesn't work. It's ineffective. Every single person who leaves is ineffective. But what they do is they say that 80-odd% of service leavers have a job. And they're like, that's thanks to career transition. But the average person changes job 4 times within 3 years. So you're getting them a job, but it's not the right job.
No. And they use that statistic that you got a job. So that's look, we're successful. We're doing right. I didn't. I couldn't fit in a civvy workplace. I hated it. Mm. And I dug out absolutely blind to stay there and make it work. And that was a year. And I probably should have left after, I reckon, 4 or 5 months. And, you know, and that's when I'm like, do you know what? Actually, I've identified that working with civilians, nothing wrong with working with civilians, but I'm not in myself in a position where I should work with civilians. You know, I've got some issues, I think, here. Mm. And that's when I was like, do you know what? I know sport. I know fitness industry. I'm going to do combat fuel and do a gym. And then that was evidently where we met. What I want to talk about a transition for you, I think a key bit is you had a parachuting accident as well, didn't you?
No, I did. Yeah. So I had I jumped in Kenya. So there were 30, I've got to get this number right. 36 of us jumped and I think there were 11 casualties. So it was like Kenya. It was like red hot. People were like fainting on their way to the aircraft. Because you've done that thing where it's like, oh, it's tactical, it's non-tac, it's tac, it's non-tac. You're in Kenya, it's tac, non-tac, non-tac, tac. So, yeah, like we patrol in and whatever. Then inevitably the RAF were late. The plane
shock.
Shock. Well, they'd crashed the truck and one of them had a bald head, had cut his bald head. So he turned on with a tampon stuck on the top of his head, trying to teach us about parachuting. And you're there like,
bro,
because you have to get like this thing like renewed, so someone has to just remind you about like how to land, parachute land, and you're looking at this guy with a tampon stuck to the top of his head and you're like, fuck it, what is going on? And so tampon head then cut us all on this aircraft, and it's like red hot. And so there's the first aircraft, the second aircraft, sorry everybody, boring army day. The first aircraft actually turned around because so many people fainted on it that the sergeant major was like, this is fucking stupid, like turn around, like I'm not letting my guys go. But the OC who was on mine was like, no, we've got to go. So the doors open, people like passed out, like my signaller like fainted. He's got loads of the batteries that I need. So it's like, oh God, thanks, cheers bud, like that. And out we go. But I'm like in absolute pieces. I'm holding on to this static line and I kind of just flop into this guy whose name is Dom. I'm actually really good mates with him still. And I like flop out of this aircraft and get in the entanglements. Yeah, and I landed with probably about half, maybe a third of my parachute, like kind of like upside down, smashed my head severely into ground. Now, as everyone can probably see, I've got a massive head. And so when everyone said, oh, Jimmy smashed his head into Kenya, the response is, oh, is Kenya okay? but yeah, like smashed my head. And I was unconscious for like 14 minutes or something, like choking on my tongue, all over the shop. I wound up getting like strapped down into a spinal board because I was like lashing out, like in bits. The C-130 had to land on the drop zone because there were so many people who were injured on the drop zone. So many people were piling in that the C-130 had to turn around, land on the drop zone. And then they just casivacked us onto the back of the C-130, took off, landed us in Nairobi and got like taken to the hospital. I'm in there with this doctor who's like, I can kind of remember him telling me that everything's going to be all right. Definitely didn't feel like it at the time. If anyone here's ever been knocked out, it's like, it was just like that. It was like, I wasn't quite waking up. And like, I couldn't open my eyes cause that was like an awful headache. And I went, to this hospital and I kind of like came to, and I'm like, I need to get out of this. So I kind of like tied into this thing. So I like Jason Bourne it to like get out of this spinal board in this hospital. There's like tapping on the window in this hospital. Cause it's like ghetto.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like hard to describe. People like who haven't, it is like something out of World War Z. There's people like trying to get in the windows, tapping on the windows. And so I'm there like, I can't stay here. So like Jason Bourne and get out. And I open the curtain and it feels like I've been in a car crash. Like my whole body hurts. And I pull the curtain. There's this medic girl standing there. And I say, what's going on? And she's like, oh my God, you need to get back into bed. Da, 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 da. And basically this doctor came and said that I had a bleed on my brain. He drew like on a piece of paper, like a circle, then did like a semicircle and went, this is the bleed on your brain. Here is a phone. Goodbye. Left. That was me for the night. Just on my own. Like that was a long ass night. Like horrible. In the morning, they'd done a scan. It turns out it wasn't a bleed. That there's a cyst. What's called a subarachnoid cyst, and that I was going to be fine. But like a severe concussion like that, I shouldn't have got stressed. Should take everything easy. Like just relax, which is like, oh okay, cheers, sound yeah. Just leave me in a room with like all these people trying to like break in and that in the night with a phone. How'd you dial an outside number from like that hospital? Like what am I supposed to do? Like that was a bad night. And so that was that. And what, 6 months later, I got given the org. So I had to go for like loads of brain scans and had to get looked at and speak to like specialists. And it was like a really scary thing. Cause you know, when they're showing you pictures of your brain and showing you like, there's a malformity there and da, 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 da. And they're talking to you about like concussions and stuff. And, you know, it was like really horrible. It was scary, like really scary. Cause I thought I'm going to die. You know, it's your brain. And, the regiment were asking when I could go back on exercise. Do you know what I mean? Like it was absolutely mental. And then, I got upgraded, but the opportunity arose, you know, a little while later after that to become a parachuting instructor. And I thought, do you know what? I actually thought that my experiences with that put me in really good stead to then explain to people about like, this is what happens when it goes wrong and da, 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 da. So I applied and got that and became like one of those APGIs. So yeah, mate, like it was an awful experience. It was, but it helped me become like a much better instructor because of those experiences. Right. And that, I think that's like the key to like everything that we talk about, right. Particularly I think what I do, and I think a lot of what you do as well, it's because we understand, because we've lived experience there. That's a lot of problem with mental health. There's not always a huge amount of lived experiences, and like academia doesn't always necessarily align to practice. And so like, I think this is like, you know, like you identify so well there that like the CT whatever partnership people, like they say this thing. So on paper that looks great, but that's not your lived experience. That's not the reality of it. Yeah. So like having people involved in positions and of influence or support who actually got lived experience, you can say, well, that's what the PAM says, but that's not the reality of it. I actually think that's really powerful and really important. And so that's what we find in mental health. And that's what I found. Having that experience allowed me to open the door to me being a better parachuting instructor, because I'd known when it had gone wrong. And so I could offer that reassurance and explain people what they needed to do. So yeah, that was crazy. I've not spoken about that in ages. I actually turned up at Bryce Norton about 6 weeks after with a bottle of rum. And I walked into the office in the parachute training school office with this bottle of rum. And I said, I'm looking for a parachute instructor, tall guy, good looking, curly hair, Welsh. And they were like, they knew exactly what I was talking about, but he's like, do you know, like suggestion of like perhaps a bit of a scoundrel. Do you know what I mean? So they're like, oh God, because there's this bloke, like back when I was a skinhead, skinhead with a bottle of rum in his hand. They're like, oh God. And he came over, but there was like loads of them came with him. And I was like, oh, that's him there, yeah. And they're like, yeah, he's coming. And he like came in, he was like, you're right, bud. Mate, I don't think you recognize me, but like you actually helped Kazi wrap me off the DZ on in Kenya, and you were like really sound. And he was like, right. And I went, well, I've got this for you, mate. And gave him a bottle of rum. I said, I really appreciate it. And he was like, oh, okay, yeah. And then like fast forward like a year later, I go there as a parachute instructor, and he's one of the instructors himself.
Wicked.
So yeah, it was cool. And we chatted just the other day. Like I've gone to his gym and like done a presentation about mental health at his gym. Like it's just another great example of how that military, that veteran community, like everyone knows each other, right?
Love it.
And that's how we work together. Yeah, that was cool. Yeah, that was a bad day at the office, eh?
And it's, you know, I've got a highlight of your career only from social media, which is when you were parachuting down and you managed to record yourself being like,
yeah,
to your daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever, that's gotta go at work.
Yeah,
have you
yeah.
got, if that isn't, have you got a highlight of your military career?
Yeah, like that was a cool thing. Like film, like doing the video on the canopy for Georgie Porge. That was cool. Like I've always been into sport. And if you're into sport, there are opportunities that like present themselves to you. So I found myself on like the Gunners tug of war team. I'm not like just pure like Hmong strength, right? Like, there's no like skill to that. And I like got invited to go to the Braemar Games up in Scotland, you know, the Highland Games.
Yeah.
And you tug of war in front of the royal family. What on earth was I doing there? Like we got absolutely so tanked, cool. By the way. Like there was no, like, you know, these like Scottish farmers who were like tent pegs on the rope and they were like, like that. And you're just there like trying to rag on this rope with your arms. So I was absolutely like, I was so bad, man. But like, that was cool. I really enjoyed that. And I think actually the work I did when I did move into the mental health team and like did the mental resilience stuff, you know, I felt like I was actually doing something really like rewarding there. And I was like really helping young soldiers develop resilience and going from unit to unit to unit and meeting all these different people and having these cool conversations. And if like I went and did the London Garrison, which was like the bands, the guards, cavalry, everyone. Yeah. And she was this brilliant colonel had just taken over as like the head of London Garrison. And she asked to speak to me afterwards. And she said, I want you to like kind of collate what the problems are and then present them to me, because you're going to speak to everybody about resilience and mental health. So at the end of it, I'd like you to present that to me. And so I got to sit there with the commander of the London Garrison and try and like suggest these ideas. And she was like, I never knew that, or that was really interesting. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. Da, 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 da. So that was quite good.
You were a corporal at this point.
Yeah.
And it's, how did you land this Army mental health resilience coach job?
Like, so I was at the parachute training school and I'd done loads within strength conditioning with Colchester Rugby Club. So I went from Colchester and being at the regiment and working with Colchester Rugby Club, and I went to the parachute training school. And what I found was that a lot of the key psychological skills that were really applicable to those young athletes were really applicable to young soldiers. So stuff like anxiety regulation, managing your emotions, performance, managing the stress of performance, all that stuff was like really pertinent to those young guys there as well. And so basically I just started to kind of incorporate that within a lot of my instructional stuff. Then like really uncharacteristically to me, having had like issues with my own mental health, I actually read some emails, and very unlike me. And one of them was like this intranet email from Army headquarters just about how they're going to change their approach to mental health. Da, 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 da. And I basically emailed him back and said, listen, this is actually my 10 pence. I think that we do it wrong because we're really reactive, but actually we should be proactive and we should be teaching young soldiers about getting emotionally overwhelmed and developing positive relationships and all that type of stuff, like actually working on people's mental. So we're not sending people DCMH when they've reached like rock bottom. We should be like preventing that. We should be teaching them how they can manage themselves and what that looks like and like developing this idea of resilience. And they actually replied and said, we really like that. Come down for a conversation. So I went down for a conversation and spoke about what I've been doing and where I was and my experiences and my perspective. And it went, cool. We really like that. Can you come here and become the second in command of British Army mental resilience training? And you'll be given the south of the country. The other guy who's running it, he's the north. And you will just go camp to camp. And the two of you will sit together. You'll design this resilience product. He's already got like a really cool thing. You'll jump in there with him and then you'll go and teach it. And I went, yeah, okay, cool.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. And that like, that was it. And it was literally like from camp to camp to camp, like coaching this resilience product. And it was like a full day. It wasn't like an hour mat brief. It was like a full 8 hour thing. Mate. And like, I went everywhere. Like Hereford guys would be on it 1 week. And then like, and they were like really interesting to do. And there's an interesting correlation that I found between, I thought that like the more sort of combat, more war-y, more allied a unit, the less into talking about things like emotional resilience they'd be. Completely wrong. The other way around. The more ally the unit, right? The more door kickery the unit, whatever the terminology is, the more interested they were in understanding why their brains did what they did, how they could further performance, what resilience looked like, what mental health like looked like the science, like really interested in the science. And that's kind of where my career then took me to go more into the science of human behavior. So that they really loved it. But actually then it was often within units that were like service support that they'd be like, oh, it's pink and fluffy. This is not necessary. But that would be like, listen, if like guys from PF and guys from Hereford and guys from like wherever, if they're like going, this is great.
This is good.
Like, you should be like, you should be all over this. Nah, it's not a problem here. And it's like, well, I've actually seen the numbers and it is.
Yeah.
So like, but it's that resistance to it, right? But yeah, I just found myself doing that. And I did that for like, I don't know, like 2 years. 2 years just going, delivering and learning and reading and doing like starting my learning journey. So doing like that effective coaching and mentoring and doing some sports psychology diplomas as well, which is really interesting. Like, why do athletes, because there's so, why do athletes behave and what do athletes need? Why do athletes behave the way they do and what are their needs? Because actually there's so much similarity between athletes and soldiers. Like so combat fuel surrounds itself with athletes. What you're really doing is you're recreating a version of the military that you probably wish you had, which is like loads of just high performance people, top of their game, mega keen, good sense of humor. Everyone understands teamwork. Yeah. Like that's what you've done here. You've just recreated like a really alley unit like that. And so like, that's what we see. We often just like, if we were to kind of jump back to the childhood stuff, we're talking about how people recreate the same dynamics that they've existed in, but trying this time to recreate it with a greater element of control. So often, why do guys date? If guys have terrible experiences with their mothers, why do they then date terrible women? It's because what you're trying to do is recreate the same dynamic that you had with your mum, but this time you're worthy of love. So it's almost like with combat fuel, what you're doing here is like you're recreating a version of the army that you deserve to have. This time you're in like control of that. So nobody, like you said, you left under a bit of a dark cloud, like you pissed off how you were treated, which is how 99% of people I speak to experience the military. It's like the saddest thing about the military is we are so bad at celebrating people's careers. Like, I like now that you see sergeant majors getting clapped off of camp, but like, it's not just the sergeant majors who deserve a proper recognition for their service.
You know, guys aren't celebrated when they're in there either, are they?
No.
A lot of the time we celebrate average or bad that became average.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And the guys that are doing well, what's your job?
Well, what's sold to you in the military is it's a meritocracy. So the better you do, the more you're rewarded for it. But that's not the case, right? So first and foremost, the reporting process in the military is fundamentally flawed because the assumption is that everyone is a good green soldier. You are not judged on that. But that is really the main thing that you should be judged on, but it's not. And so that is where this becomes hideously unfair. So you get a guy who is like, I am a green soldier, I'm good at this, this is what I do, but they don't organize mess dues or they're not involved in a regimental sport.
Yeah.
Their career gets laid to the side compared to someone who is.
Or it's for like celebrating, I can run a mile and a half in shorts and t-shirt.
Yeah, cool.
Cheers, Tam.
Yeah. Yes. Nice. Yeah.
We'll promote them because they're fit.
Yeah.
But guy that can tab for days on end.
Yeah.
You know,
can set an OP up, can win firefights, can establish, can do all of that. Yeah, but that's expected of you. You're doing your job.
Yeah, well done, it's your job.
Yeah.
But
Yeah. So it's not a meritocracy. And the problem then that you've got, right? Okay, so the army is a pyramid. There's one chief of general staff slot. There's one commander field army, right? There's one, and there's tens of thousands of private soldiers, right? It's a pyramid. Cool. The further up the rank sides you go, the less of those jobs that there are. But that doesn't funnel the best because it's not a meritocracy. What that funnels is people who stayed. I'm not saying that's true in every case. I have met some unbelievably outstanding sergeant majors. When I was actually in the mental health training team, one of the biggest supporters of it was the army sergeant major at the time, Gaz, the enormous guy, but he was like a larger than life character as well. Yeah. And like a guy of real integrity. Like that guy there, he was great. And so there are some wonderful, wonderful senior NCOs. I'm not saying this is true for all senior NCOs, but this is the byproduct that you get when it's not a meritocracy and the jobs get fewer. The good guys will just leave. They'll go and set up combat fuel.
Yep. The same for officers, you know?
Yep.
A lot of officers that are, you know, whatever, we'll go. And not the same as all of them after, you know? And I work with a lot of officers, a lot of senior NCOs still now with combat fuel, and they're exceptional. You know, they're brilliant at what they do. So just to be clear, like, if you're watching this and you're one of the guys that works with us, it's not you, but there are a lot of it.
Yeah, of course,
you know, it's very frequent.
Yeah,
you know,
And so then the good guys will just leave because if going and doing like a really good job, right? And I was never rank bothered, so it didn't necessarily become that much of a problem. And I know a lot of guys aren't, but there are ways of rewarding people without having to promote them. So if you're basically not getting rewarded for your hard work, you're just going to go somewhere that will. You're just going to find somewhere that will. That's why like so many units complain that, you know, you get these really good full screws and then they leave. There is only like, because they're not feeling valued. If they're not feeling valued, that super switched on, proactive, brilliant guy or girl is just going to go somewhere where they are.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think this comes a lot to leadership as well. You know, I served with Royal Anglians, one Vikings, and we didn't really have this mindset at all. It was, you know, the whole, you got to do 4 years in a rank, otherwise you're getting filled in, you don't deserve to promote. We didn't have really any of that, you know?
Yeah.
Because before my time, the guys had deployed a lot of Herricks, one of the most decorated battalions in Afghanistan. And it was, lads were promoted based on if you're a good soldier or not. And it showed, you know, it absolutely showed. We had guys progressing through the ranks that, without naming names, he was a colour sergeant after 10 years service.
Yeah, cool.
Which is unheard of, isn't it? You know, he should be maybe looking at sergeant if he's doing very well. Like, but normally 12-year point, but colour sergeant at just over 10 years service was mad. Like, all the way up, every RSM I knew when I was in, brilliant guys, promoting through the ranks at an above average rate. And the guys that were set over us were there for a reason. None of them, we didn't really have the promoter on time. But equally, we had a bunch of guys that were like happy to be private soldiers and stay there.
Okay, so then when the army is no longer an institution at war, which I'm not anti, by the way, like I like, but then how do you then choose who to promote?
Absolutely. And as a result of that, when the Herrick's finished, the flip side of it is the guys left.
Yeah, you look at that voluntary redundancy.
And then it's...
How much did the army shoot itself in the foot with voluntary redundancy? Because so many people applied for it.
Yeah.
They were like, oh, we didn't realise you'd all leave. Like, there's nothing in it for them anymore.
Yeah, if there's, especially for an infantry battalion, what else are we going to do? Go on exercise for the next however long?
Yeah,
We're probably never going to see another Iraq, Afghan, hopefully, in our lifetimes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so why join the infantry then? I mean, I'd still advocate it. I think it's a brilliant thing to do, at least for the minimum service.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. The opportunities are endless. But for a whole career, why?
Yeah. And how do you then upskill that person?
Yeah.
Like, what do you then do? Like you're right. Like, close in with and kill the enemy, right? Mission statement number one. Okay, cool. What do you now do with that person then?
Yeah.
Like, if they're not at war, how do you upskill, maintain, motivate? Because if someone does 4 years and they've seen Otterburn, oh God, that's just put a thing through. They've seen Otterburn, Brecon and Salisbury Plain. How do you convince them to do another 4 years?
And it's just the same exercises that are going to circle over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, without it, you know, let's hope Russia doesn't kick off. But, and I'm sure at that kind of scale, the likelihood is it isn't.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so how do you keep the guys?
I think you can, what you can do is you can now, you can reinstate the idea that the British Army is a force for good. So you can go and build schools and you can go and provide stability in unstable areas and you can go on do peacekeeping operations without it being imperialistic, without it being dominant. You can go and do like the good stuff. If a guy who like joins infantry, but, oh, you know, I've spent X amount of time building homes, or I spent X amount of time providing counter poacher stuff in Kenya. Like, those are stuff. And everyone's like, oh, he's got a peace chest. Oh, he's a sergeant and all he's got is coronation and...
Can't help when he was born though, can he?
Can't help when he's born.
Yeah.
Like, and then it's just, then the issue, because we find this a lot, right, is belittling within the toxic parts of the veteran community. So I would identify any form of like kind of toxic behaviors where you feel the need to try and dominate another person, right? Whether we're talking about masculinity, the veteran community, whatever, if you feel the need to constantly dominate other people, it creates a toxic environment where people just like, I just don't want to be around that person, right? I don't want to be in this. This is awful. Don't want to be in this relationship. Don't want to be with this person. Don't want to be with this group, whatever. That's how I would define it, right? So like when we have like the toxic veteran community and they're like slagging off these young lads, what you've got to understand is a lot of these young lads are still struggling with their mental health issues. And a lot of these young lads now feel like disempowered to speak to someone about their mental health because they're like, oh yeah, but I didn't deploy to Afghan, or I wasn't, you know, I was there 2010, 2011. Like, people are like, oh, I wasn't there then. Like, I haven't done anything like that. And it's like, listen, I haven't done anything like that. Like, and the next veteran who says they haven't, and they haven't, and they're like, don't even think about that. Because where does it stop? Like, guys from Afghan feel like they can't speak out because guys said it wasn't as bad as Iraq, and the Iraq guys don't want to speak out because it wasn't as bad as the first one. And then the Falklands, and then the Korean War, and then the Second World War. Next thing you know, you've got, well, you didn't lose your eye in the Battle of Hastings, so what do you know? Like, just don't even entertain that, right? Just come and speak to someone about your mental health if you're struggling with your mental health, because the toxic side of their veteran community, which is actually, generally speaking, the most vocal, like, they're the loudest. Like, the 99.999% of the veteran community are not toxic like that, and they're like, bro, like, what do you need? How can we help? Are you okay? Is everything all right? Like, the vast majority of them are like that, but it's that narrative of, oh, you've got a peace chest, you haven't done anything with your career, that then means that those guys feel like they can't speak out.
And where do you draw the line on what's banter, though? You know, cause I love ripping some of my mates for it, but how do you distinguish between what's banter and where's the line of actually you're just being toxic and a bit of a dick?
Genuine intent. Like, what's a genuine intent? And instantly, the perpetrator of that can say, oh, I'm only joking. So, like, it's an element, therefore, of the individual who's on the receiving end of it and people who are bystanders. Like, if you, like, apathy just enables an abuser. Someone going, I don't want to get involved, just means that bloke who's a bit of a bully gets away with being a bit of a bully more. Like, and I just want to point out that, like, I'm not always proud of my service. Like, I was of that era of, like, big, bolshy gobshites. Like, I was a big, bolshy gobshite. I've come out the other side of that and gone through the therapy. That was normalized and accepted and promoted behavior. And the people who could have intervened and stopped me, like, either were apathetic towards it or were encouraging of it. Yeah. So, like, when we say, oh, I don't want to get involved, what you're actually doing is you're empowering that person. So what comes banter is if somebody says something like, oh, that's gone too far. I'm only joking. Okay, but that has now gone too far. I think everyone's entitled to, like, be told that they've gone too far, like, almost like you warn it.
And that person should be accepting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, mate.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Taken on board.
Yeah, it was a joke, but I didn't realise it would have that response, and I'm very sorry. Yeah. Okay, cool. That is absolutely banter, and then we should create environments where people feel like they can say, that has gone too far now. It's when people exist in environments that are so toxic where they can't say that.
That's a really good point. You know, like, Fraser, who's filming his podcast now, he's as bald as you like, and he's like 23 years old or something, looks about 40. So we like giving him a lot of abuse, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I also feel like, based on saying that, like, if something goes too far, he'd be like, actually, bro.
Yeah.
That's a bit much. And don't get me wrong, they'll rip me as hard as you want, be editing some reels, and it'll be there, like, effing and blinded at me, like, fucking illiterate infantry brick.
Like. But the difference, because of the relationship that exists, right? There's an element of trust and love that exists between, like, all veterans, right? That we all kind of shared experience of that kind of thing. Like, we never directly serve with each other, although Fraser did say that he knew of me from my pre-power days, which makes me feel like really embarrassed. Yeah, absolute prick. He's going to beat me up in the car park in a minute. But there's that, like, shared thing that we've all got, right? And we can, you can say things to each other that you definitely can't say to a civilian, right? Yeah. Like, there's ways that we would talk to each other that when I'm on, if I'm in front of a committee board trying to get them to invest in my product, I'm definitely not going to call one of them a fucking screamer. Do you know what I mean? But, like, that's okay for us to speak to each other like that. That's okay, but because the intent is there, and there's that pre-existing relationship. And if you were to say something else, you'd be like, actually, bro, you'd be like, oh shit, sorry, mate. Yeah. Like, genuinely, it was an accident, and I didn't mean it. Like, and I'm sorry, it won't happen again. Okay, cool. So, for me, that line between when has banter become something that's really toxic is first and foremostly the intent. And you see people act like dicks towards someone, and you're like, you're just trying to dominate that person to make yourself feel better about yourself. Just chill out, man. Like, it's embarrassing. And, like, we're all grown up enough now to see what you're doing. So, like, the more you do that to him, the more we dislike you.
Yeah.
So what's the intent? And secondly, like, if the person were to call it out, what would the response to that be? And if the response to that is, oh, I'm really sorry, mate, like, I didn't realise it won't happen again, da, 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 then cool, then it's not, there's nothing toxic about that. But it's when you say, actually, mate, like, probably don't make a joke about that, like, da, 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 da. Yeah. And they're like, oh God, they're such a snowflake. And it's like, actually, mate, like, your response to being called out suggests that it's you are being hypersensitive because actually you know that you've been called out. So just chill, like, just chill, man. Just relax on that. So that's where I would identify that, but there's a maturing time within the army, and I think there's something that doesn't often get appreciated enough, which is we're children. until like you maturing into like young men. And then by the time you potentially leave after 22 years, like you're a fully grown man. And within that time, like you're going to have to grow up and you're going to have to learn those things through trial and error. You're like, and I'm not excusing behavior, but I'm just trying to get people to like understand better that sometimes soldiers make huge mistakes because they're kids and they're kids from really difficult backgrounds and they make really terrible
mistakes
choices.
Mistakes are allowed though, right? You know, mistakes are allowed. It's what should be judged is your response to the mistake you've made.
Right. Obviously, like you can't murder someone and be like, oh, my bad.
Banner.
Shit, didn't do that. Shouldn't have done that. But yeah, like one of the things that I always really struggled with was when I was ever in trouble, which was a lot, getting shouted at by like a sergeant major for like say having a fight on a Saturday night or whatever. And they're shouting at you for that. And you're like, but you're known as being one of the worst for this. Like apparently you were an absolute nightmare as a Tom. So why, like, what is this? Cause this is then that's just performative rage.
Yeah.
You're not really angry. You're just pretending to be really angry to try and belittle me because you've got this opportunity to do so. But like what I've done hasn't personally affected you. Why are you angry about it?
Yeah.
It wasn't you I had a fight with. It was just some knobhead. Like, well, who cares? Like, why are you so angry about it? Yes, I deserve to be punished. Yes, put me through the system. Da, 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 da. But why are you screaming and shouting? And it's the reason why that person is screaming and shouting is because the really decent guy who would have been an amazing sergeant major got out 10 years ago because it wasn't in a meritocracy. The guy who'd sit there and go, you fucked up, but you don't need me to shout at you for that, do you? No, you know that, right? This is what's going to happen. Yeah. Da, 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 da,
far
da.
More productive.
Far more productive. So that. Yeah. What it comes down to is intent. Or it's always about what did you mean to do? And if you've offended someone, that intent doesn't mean that you are excused from making that mistake. It just means that like, you're not judged, you're not punished for it. You just, oh, stop. And quite often as young men, we will do that, cross that line a lot, and we'll need pushing back. There is, yeah, and there's loads to learn from that. We do, with that, we also need to be like, I feel like within the military, particularly a lot of the men that I work with, we need to hammer that into them about being more supportive of vulnerable members of teams, including how we approach and treat women within our teams and within our units. There are women in combat roles now. So what was historically just groups of men fighting each other, there are now women in that. There's lines that have to be drawn. If she says, I don't find that funny, stop. Because that's not okay. And that's like that's something that the military is having to go through now. And there's lots of people who I feel like have taken a little bit of advantage of that. And there's lots of women who have been really mistreated by the system and let down. And I think that the army is going to have to look at how we approach this, because perhaps there's a better way, a more effective way of communicating this than a yearly D&I brief.
Yeah. It's powerful stuff, Jimmy, man. Thank you. Let's get into your business now.
Cool.
How did you start it? Where did it come from? I mean, there's so much to unpack with it.
Like right.
Working on Harley Street,
it was cool.
It's pretty prestigious, isn't it?
It is pretty prestigious, yeah. That was just a mad time. It still is like mad. I get like all these like really, the doctor who runs my clinic is the doctor for the Enhanced Games, which is just so cool. Yeah, right. It's so cool. So like, yeah. So I left the army basically because I was just getting really messed around in the mental health team. It was really badly managed. It was really badly ran. I'm really thankful for some of the people who were there who went, Jim, let's sit down. You are like running resilience coaching. Like there are an unbelievable amount of opportunities for you. Maybe start exploring that. I started exploring that for about 5 minutes and got invited to go to the Paralympic rowing team and brief there.
Yep.
Left brief there, got all of these opportunities presented themselves to me, terminated. I actually went in and the woman who ran mental health it was a civilian woman. And I spoke about my career and she went, I'll stop you. You're never going to leave the army, James. You need it too much. And I was like, oh shit. Okay. I went, all right. Thank you very much for your time. And I got up and I left and I went and signed off like there and then. We just went to the nearest terminal and just did the... It was seven clicks of freedom. I believe it's 11 clicks now. They've made it 4 clicks harder to do. That will slow them down. So I did the, and went into the 7 clicks of freedom and then went into, effective coaching and mentoring and did like counseling courses and night school and did all of that stuff. I did all of that through COVID. And I always pushed this narrative of like how you treat your body is gonna have a massive effect on your mental health, but also your mental health has a massive effect on how you choose to treat your body. So there's this great psychiatrist called Gabor Mate who says, don't ask why the addiction, ask why the pain. So like someone who like drinks loads or takes loads of drugs or eats loads, they know, cognitively they know that what they're doing isn't great for them, but they don't respect themselves or something awful has happened or whatever has gone on that they've gone, I just need to escape how awful my existence is by doing this. Like why is somebody like chronically addicted to dopamine, these rushes of dopamine we get from alcohol and drinking and drugs, why is somebody chronically addicted to that? Is it because they like being high or is it because actually they're so miserable internally that they need to find a way out of that? And so basically like I just built on that idea, the idea of developing resilience to improve like well-being, not just performance, but like well-being and mental health, and did my counseling because I wanted to provide like a really good product. So I didn't just want to be coach. I wanted to do my psychotherapy counseling courses because I wanted to provide something that could fundamentally like really help people do like a really in deep, good product that encompassed everything. So you could understand about why they were the way they were, you know, the childhood stuff that affected who they became, and then be able to use the resilience side of it to coach them. So that's what I wanted to do. And yeah, and a guy who, the power of social media, who was following me on social media, this guy, Dr. Michael Sagner, and he said, can we have a conversation? And I was like, yeah. And we met in London and we met in what is it called? He'll laugh at me for not being able to remember, but it's like the Ralph Lauren Cafe in like Oxford Street. You know, it's all like gold and yeah, that in there, yeah. Mate, like beaut. And like we're meeting in there and I'm like, I'm wearing like the only shirt that I've got. Do you know what I mean? The only like iron trousers and polished shoes that I've got. I took everything that I could to not bull the ends of me civvy shoes. You know what I mean? Like you're that much of a civvy crow. And he was literally like talking to me about all this stuff and we swapped ideas and he said, yeah, I'll be in contact. And then I went and he had a place at Soho Farmhouse. So I went there and we had lamb together. Like, you know, just like that guy, like real cool guy. He's ex Swedish SF diver. Do you know what I mean? His shirts are always way more unbuttoned than mine. Like, I'm bad for unbuttoned shirts. He's always tanned. And like, we would chat and catch up and da da da. And then he basically said, listen, he's got clinics in the Mediterranean and he's got opening clinics in America. And he's like, I'm opening a clinic on Harley Street and I'm looking for someone to run like the resilience and psychotherapy side of stuff. So when someone's in there, I can refer them to you. If you'd be interested. And I was like, yeah. He said, come along to the clinic and we'll have a walk around and show you what I think. And if you've never been on Harley Street, mate, it's absolutely, have you been onto Harley Street? Absolutely mental. Yeah. So anyone who hasn't, and like, obviously I'd never had any experience of anything like this. They're like big old Victorian houses, aren't they? And you go in and it's like these massive doors and you'll just open it and it'll just be like an operating theater in there. It's just like, so just go in and like, so he's saying like, say if we do like in the clinic, we'll do like same day surgery. So you can go with a bad back. They basically then just scan and they'll show you on the iPad, go, oh, you've got a bit of a bulging disc there. We'll get the anaesthetist in, the surgeon will come in, ODP will come in. They put you in the theater, put them to sleep, operate on them. A Bentley pulls up out the front. They get loaded into the Bentley. They get sent home.
Crazy.
Crazy. I was like, oh my God. And he was like, this would be your office. And like I've got a balcony that like overlooks Harley Street and we did like loads of photos in there. And then we just started having, you know, anyone who basically was involved in sort of like cutting edge performance stuff would go into like, I mean, I did like cognitive tests, like reactive tests, like all the diodes and all that stuff stuck to your head, doing all these like cognitive reactive tests. And they're just showing me like the difference in reactive speeds and what we can do and how like we can then employ these cognitive processes to like develop people's. And you're like, wow, this should be really, and basically it was about sales. They're trying to sell us this thing. So we put it into the clinic so the athletes could use it. So it was just like all this cutting edge stuff. But I mean, that's been an amazing part of my life. And I still take referrals from there. But as like the business grew and developed, I was finding myself working with more groups. I go and support more veteran groups and stuff. So going into Harley Street and actually going into the office just became like, if I go into Harley Street to talk to an individual in that office, that's like a day. But if I can do it via Zoom, I can speak to 10 people that day.
Yeah.
So it just became more about doing it via Zoom. I'm still like connected there. I still like speak to the doctor all the time and we still chat. And we'll meet up. He's actually just moved to like 10 minutes down the road from me now, which is cool. Yeah, he's just got a place in the Cotswolds. So we're just going to meet up there and chat some stuff over. But yeah, like a great guy, like really, really like fascinating, interesting guy. Who's, and yeah, mate, like finding yourself there as a squaddie. And I think that there's a lot to be taken away for individuals who are from working class and impoverished backgrounds, who then can make their way, who've been facilitated and given opportunities to get out of that, actually then have a lot of wisdom to then impart onto people who haven't had those experiences. It's actually one of the things that annoys me a little bit about resilience, because I speak to people who like, say, work in corporate wellbeing and resilience coaching, training, stuff, right? They have these products. And they go into like businesses, they go into banks, whatever. They charge like $2,500-$3,000 a day. Wow. Right. And you're like, what's your story? Oh, I worked in finance. I worked in finance for 30 years. Then I burnt out. So then I set up a coaching model to help people with resilience. And you're like, that's such bullshit, man. What were we even talking? So your greed drove you to that point. Yeah. And now you're running a product where you're charging like $3,000 a day. And there are people who I know, veterans who've like left the military, who've got these amazing stories, who've like really studied and worked hard. They should be charging $3,000 a day, but they don't. They charge 500 because they don't value themselves enough, even though they should. And like their experiences absolutely dwarf yours, and yet you've got the monopoly on this. And because it's a reflection of privilege, because you sit in that tax bracket and always have done your whole life, your friends are more likely to pay you to turn up. Yeah. And there's guys who are way better than you who are knocking on that door, but that door will never get open for them because they're not from that tax bracket. Yeah, crazy. So just the business developed. And yeah, so I did some work with Icarus, which was a charity that supported veteran mental health. We did counseling and stuff with them. They were great, really super intense, but really great. And I loved it. And next thing led to the next thing, led to the next thing. And now I run this program helping veterans transition out of prison. I'll still take individuals one-to-one. People reach out all the time. I still take referrals from the clinic on Harley Street. Now these big projects is like a real opportunity to like change the system, you know, like create better infrastructure for veterans.
Yeah.
If we can, like one of the things I'll talk about is Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for veterans.
Yeah.
So I wrote my master's on that. I wrote Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu as a complementary therapeutic practice for veterans. Could it be considered complementary therapy? If we prescribe things like yoga, could we prescribe things like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? And my argument, which I got a distinction for it, was, yeah, absolutely you can. And this is why, producing models based around well-being and actually how does Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu fit into that? So like that paper that's been written about how BJJ is really, really good for your mental health. That was mine. Yeah. I wrote that. I limped to the end. I had like so much help with it because I was like calling upon people like, help me, this is so hard. Got it over the line and it went down really well. So now I include things like BJJ. Like more veterans should be doing BJJ.
100%. You know, personal experience is brilliant. You're a purple belt now?
No, blue.
Nearly purple?
Yeah.
Nearly purple.
He says, gets tapped in the kids class. So basically I used the PERMA model, which is positive emotions, engagement, relationships, meaning, and achievement, which is basically the model that we use to decide if something is a well-being practice. So if something meets all of those, is that a well-being practice? And I say BJJ does. Okay, cool. But then that's just my bias. So then what I had to do is go and find proof that it does. Yeah. So what I then did is a secondary research by getting basically like literature review. So I got every paper that's ever been written about the mental health and combat sports focusing on Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And then I went and extracted the things that they said from the evidence, whether they had like, say, for example, quantitative data where they got people to rate their mood before BJJ and then they rated their mood after BJJ. And I said, right, CP, positive emotions.
Yeah.
I've got five papers here written by these guys that show that there are positive emotions that come from doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Therefore, that fits into the P, positive. But it's not just the fact that it's well-being. Why specifically to veterans? Because there's lots of reflections of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu within the military structure. So when you ask there is, like, effectively what you ask me is, what's your rank? It's a rank structure.
Yeah.
You know, like, and when we wear belts, there's a very clear rank structure and how you stand and how you dress and how you walk and how you talk to those people, what is okay to do. Like, like in the army, we're making it less and less okay to bully younger guys. It's not okay to heel hook white belts.
Yep.
Right, it's it's this is frowned upon and that's frowned upon. You shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. So there's a rank structure. There's a clear code of ethics. You're part of something, right? That's one of the best things about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is you see the full spectrum of society, right? It's the only place where a police officer could strangle a convict and get away with it. because it's true, right?
And if there's I'm not going to say that.
Yeah, but it's interesting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's no other sport, you know, I think, although it may be changing a little bit, like boxing, there's a lot of animosity and it sells tickets, but you don't really have that in jiu-jitsu. It's a shaking hands, chatting before, have a scrap with someone.
Yeah.
If you're competing, shake your hands, carry on the conversation from 5 minutes previous.
Whenever I see these reels whereby someone gets overexcited in a competition, I always think, I guarantee you're a piece of shit. Like if you slap someone or like hit someone in competition, like in mid-round, it's always like, what are you doing?
And if you need to do that, maybe just try being better at jiu-jitsu.
So and then there's like the aggression, like there's hanging out of your ass, and then there's open mat back to back where you're the worst one on the mat and everyone's beating you up
because
I love it.
It's humbling, it's a different form of fizz. You know, we've fizzed our whole lives. And it can become a bit monotonous, I think, because it's something that's new, it's different, and we're arguably shit at it.
Yeah.
Like anyone that thinks they're anyone, when you start, you're not. You're awful.
It's just so funny now. Like when you have like a better understanding of how important something like ground game is.
Yeah.
And you just realize how vulnerable you really were your whole life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like if you realize how many 17-year-olds will
destroy you.
Yeah. All they have to do is get a hand on you. The moment that they touch you, it's over. And everybody says that's not true. And then everyone in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu says that's definitely true.
So because I remember turning up thinking, this guy, his name's Clive, he's like 60 years old.
Yeah.
He's got a bit of a belly, you know, bit rough around the edges, lovely chap. I thought, brown belt. What's that?
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, this ain't gonna be hard. Oh my God.
Yeah.
First session, I was like, what is this?
Yeah.
Like, I can't even move.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you doing to me?
Yeah, yeah.
Why can't I move?
Yeah,
and it's
like,
wow. And then you've got 16-year-old kids that you think they're a kid.
Yeah.
Nah, absolutely not.
So one of the great things about the gym I was at was the Combat Institute. It's run by this guy called James Webb, who's Cage Warriors light heavyweight champion. When Tom Aspinall walked out for his fight, Webby was on his shoulder on the last one. So like he ran the gym, right? Yeah. Like, so it's just when like he would roll and he'd be like, I said, Webby, you roll in. He was like, yeah, we'll go. And then it's just 5 minutes of like, just trying to survive.
Yes.
Not failing, but just trying to survive.
And it's like, still so enjoyable, isn't it?
It is.
It's
and
so
like,
enjoyable.
I never thought that like, that would just become so addictive and so great. But we have a fight team there and they all compete in Cage Warriors and some of them are professional. So it's just this like energy and you'd have like this young lad called Ryder. He'll love that I've brought him up on a podcast. A young lad called Ryder. And I think when I met him, I think he was 14, maybe 15. And like, he would just tap me and tap me and tap me and tap me. And you're like, oh my God, this kid is horrible. Yeah. The loveliest young man, like just really kind and caring. And like, they all are, but like just this lovely young man, but just an app. You look at him and you think, whatever, like I think he's like 60 kilograms, something like that. Like you'd be like, whatever. Absolutely would ruin your day. And to this day, if I'm rolling, he's like, we'll go. Because it's obviously like a, you know, it's a slightly different story now. But he's just up for it. Like he just wants it. And it's so indicative of being, so nostalgic of being in the army and having like young Toms when you're like a little, like a full screen, you've got young Toms who are like fit and keen, who like want it. And it reminds you of those guys. And you're like, yeah, like that's, it's recreating that same dynamic as we spoke about before, recreating that same dynamic. But this time you've got a little bit more control and that's what's so enjoyable about it. Yeah, yeah. And so I put all of that into a paper and the importance of social networking. Soldiers are really bad at networking. Because I want to sit in my house now and say everyone's a piece of shit and everyone's a screamer apart from me. Like that, I'm just going to there's an inch of wall over there that doesn't have a piece of military memorabilia on it. I need to put something on that, and I'm going to sit here and be really moody. And you're like, actually, when you get out into the outside world and you do mix with some of these guys, like, it completely changes your life. And like, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a wonderful way of just meeting good, like-minded people, you know? Whether or not you meet someone and you've got some plastering that needs doing, and oh, that's okay, because the local purple belt is a plasterer and he'll come and do it. And yeah, then you'll come and have a laugh with him.
It's a non-military, military, but it's another community.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is.
You touched on earlier, the army advert of This Is Belonging.
Yeah.
And everyone belongs in jiu-jitsu, you know?
Yeah.
There's great banter pretty much everywhere you go. The lines are drawn where they are. I know there's obviously always bad sides to it and some stuff for women, but generally women are safe.
Yeah.
You know, where else can I go and like have a scrap with a woman?
Yeah, yeah.
In a safe, controlled way where they're not going to be injured.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also humbling as well when you've got a girl, woman folding you up, and I'm like, I want to be embarrassed by this, and you're just not. You're just like, yeah, oh, cool. That's wicked.
Yeah, yeah, we've got one, Emma, and like she's just like, it's like psychotically hard as nails. So like her rib pops out, but she's like, don't worry about it, just keep going.
Yeah,
you know, Emma, please stop. And she's like double jointed. And the first time I found out she was double jointed was in side control, straight in the arm out, just armbar from side control, typical heavyweight, and like her arm goes all the way back.
Yeah.
And it's like, Emma, please. And she's like, it's fine, I'm double jointed. And you're like, what the fuck is going on? Yeah. Please stop. But like, these girls are like hard as nails, man. They're
because like, all of your like male instinct is to, I shouldn't be attacking, I shouldn't be hurting a woman.
Yeah.
And then, you know. Like,
yeah. Yeah, but like they're hard as nails. Like,
send it.
Yeah, send it. Yeah, yeah. Like they're hard as nails. Like, yeah, it's they're the ones least likely to give away a tap. They're not she's not giving
you work for that.
She is not giving you that tap. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. She's like, nope, no, I'll tell you when it's on.
Yeah.
Oh, all right, Emma. You know?
Bad.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And so I took that and I put that into a scientific paper. And now what I do is one of the many aspects of the program that I'm doing, helping veterans transition out of prison, right? Teaching to the prison service to encourage them into stuff like combat sports, because there's also actually a huge amount of emotional control that comes into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu that lots of people really struggle with.
Yeah.
Like when you're on the bottom, when you're 4 minutes into a 6 minute round and you've been on the bottom for that entire time, it is hard not to lose your temper, and you have to stay calm and focus and think and stop and learn that emotional regulation. And actually that's something that a lot of squaddies think they're really good at, but they're actually not, particularly now when they lack the social support, they don't have the army system to protect them. They're now out on their own. They're very isolated. They actually become quite emotional and reactive, making like big mistakes. And so actually a great way to help teach that emotional resilience is go and do some Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and learn from that. Brilliant. Yeah.
Let's get a piece of advice off you, Jimmy. Let's go with veterans. One piece of advice for someone that's struggling.
So if we're talking about struggling with your emotional health, one of the key aspects that we do is get people to like zoom out. So an abnormal response to an abnormal situation must actually be considered normal. So quite often we get diagnosis and symptoms the wrong way around. Hear me out. So I was like diagnosed with depression as a child, but I would say that depression was actually the symptoms. The diagnosis was the environment. So this kid feels like everything is completely pointless and futile and useless. I mean, he's being fairly systemically abused by people who should protect him. Nobody's jumping up to protect this child. Nobody's looking after him. So the diagnosis is depression. No, I'm feeling depressed because of these things. So we talk about a piece of advice for veterans is, let's first and foremost stop. Let's reach out and get the support, because what we often find when we're in a much calmer space is we're able to identify what is creating this distress.
Yeah.
Take, for example, loneliness, right? Lots of veterans really, really struggling. The diagnosis here is actually loneliness. It's not depression. The diagnosis is actually loneliness, because you spend so much time socially isolated. That's just one example of what it might be. So then we encourage them to reintegrate into groups. Things like veteran associations, things like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, things like sports clubs, all great opportunities for veterans to reintegrate. Rather than going, that person is depressed and lonely. No, that person is depressed because they're lonely. Let's solve the loneliness and see what that does to that. So my piece of advice to veterans is reach out and get the support, because you're far more likely to be able to find out what the source of the problem is, and then we can address that rather than sitting there and this becomes a greater problem when actually the source of it is something that we could solve together a long time ago.
Love it. That's a really, really good bit of information.
Thanks, man.
And there is support out there.
You're loads.
There are community groups out there for veterans that need it. And a piece for your younger self. Let's take it, you know, the worst point of your childhood when you're quite young. What piece of advice would you give to your younger self?
Just because these people are like that doesn't mean that everybody is like that. Because that's really hard, because as a child, they're the yardstick. So not every woman is going to let you down. Not every man is going to let you down, but you carry that with you throughout childhood. And we become really avoidant as adults. Even like, there's just like loads of stuff. Like, how many veterans don't really like staying at each other's houses? We'd rather get hotels. Why? You're being avoidant because you're so used to being let down. And that's something from childhood that you've carried into adulthood. So if I could say to my younger self, not everybody is going to be like that. I would also say to my younger self, like, ask Faye out sooner. Don't wait until you're 35 to ask Faye out. Ask her out as a teenager, because like, she's the one. Like, you didn't have to wait 20 years to ask that question. Do you know what I mean?
But obviously, congratulations on your marriage last year, man.
Yeah, it was cool, man. It was cool. Wicked. Yeah, mate. Beautiful, you know, and like marrying the girl that used to sit next to at school, you know, like it's something really nice. But what was funny, right, was that the at the wedding, because we did 30 man wedding, and we did a banquet table. So we got married at Clearwell Castle, right, and we had a banquet table, which is so cool, by the way, because then you've just got like all of your mates sat on one long table. Yeah. You feel like King Henry VIII. And then like her bridesmaids were like her friends from school.
Yeah.
And then like my groomsmen, like one of them was Swede, who like I met when I was like 18. So it was like this whole chronological aspect of my life was like all on one table.
Yeah.
And like, so like Georgina, my daughter, sat next to me, and like, she's 15 this year. Crazy. So Georgie was there, and like my best friends were there. And then there's like this, like we all were like in the same English, maths, history, science classes together, like all on one long table, which was just absolutely mad and like really beautiful. But yeah, that man, that, yeah, it was great. Like great. Like I loved getting married, and I'm still at that phase where, and I hope I always am, but I really enjoy being married. It's like a cool thing to be, you know?
Awesome.
It's nice, man. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Any misconceptions you want to address while you're here of anything?
Misconceptions that I want to address about anything. I guess one of the key things that I find myself doing a lot is always, there's nothing wrong with being skeptical of information, but please make sure you're skeptical of all information. Apply the same skepticism that you would apply to something that disagrees with your biases as you do to the things that agree with your biases. So like, if you're really pro something and you see a headline that agrees with you, and then you see a headline that disagrees with you, the same skepticism you apply to that, you should apply to that as well, because that will then lead you to the truth and actually what is going on and why. Apply skepticism to all of it. Like, look at things like, we don't do enough like critical thinking. Education, full stop. But like, if you were to do something like a scientific, If I talk about PICO, which is persons, population, interventions, controls, and outcomes, right? That's how we analyze. That's one way of many, many ways. And like, it's like data analysis is like insanely hard to do. But like, one of the ways that we like identify scientific papers is who are the people involved and who are the people who made it. So if I was to say, for example, every single person in the army can run a sub 8 minute mile and a half, you'd be like, no, they can't. Your first question would be, where on earth have you got that from? Yeah. Which is the perfect question. So who are the people who are involved in that? So who made the experiment?
Yeah.
Why did they make that experiment? And who did they use in that experiment? Well, it turns out that they are the makers of Silver Shadows, and they use Silver Shadow trainers. And the people that they used was the PT Core Endurance team.
Yeah.
So is that then, is that a fair group that they've created that from? No. So first and foremostly, skepticism. Who are the people involved in this, and why have they done it? Things like, there was a paper that came out that was basically like anti-climate change, and climate change isn't a thing. But like the guy was like paid by oil companies to create this thing. So it was like that should disregard that paper, right? Entirely. But so if I was to create a paper and that, so first and foremostly, and then the interventions. Okay, cool. So like the headline is like super fit. But okay, well, what are the interventions that we've put in there? Well, it was running a mile and a half. But a mile and a half is not, as you pointed out earlier on, is not, that's not indicative to someone who's a good soldier, not even necessarily that fit. They can just do that thing. Like, and the control was the distance that they ran and the time that they ran. And what was the outcomes? Well, the outcomes that you proved is that that tiny group of people happened to be really, really fit and that they could do that. But you have your outcomes, you haven't actually proven that. But by taking that and then presenting that as misinformation, you've now gone, these people are like, the army's super fit then. Yeah. So you should take that skepticism of everything that you will read and apply it to anything that you hear and read. So someone goes, oh, study showed da-da-da-da. What study?
Yeah.
Like you see this all the time on podcasts, right? Someone will go, oh, study showed, what study?
What study?
Because as I've shown there with just that made up one about the PT Corps, I could generate a study that shows anything that I want. Like I could Google studies that show... studies that show informed sport is the best thing ever. You go, absolutely fucking not. You want to throw that chair. I can see it in your eyes. But I could Google that and I could find that.
Yeah.
And then I could go on a podcast and say a study shows this.
Yeah.
But that study is like massively flawed. All I've done is I've just reinforced my bias by finding something that agrees with me. And I've used that to say, oh, this is true then. But that's not how science works. And that's not how it works. We take like consensus. Yeah. So like what loads of studies show. If you were to cross a bridge and there were 100 scientists there and 99 of those scientists says that's completely safe and one scientist said I'm not sure that it is, you'd listen to the 99. The 99 say it's absolutely fine. Yeah. So it's like about consensus. We need to take like how do we identify misinformation? Because we can't rely on social media platforms to talk about misinformation. We can't rely on groups to talk about misinformation. You have to learn how to spot that as an adult, and you have to then learn how to read information so that you can go, I don't buy that. I think that's shit. You know, how you talk about certain ingredients that go into products and people are like, oh, I heard, and like God knows, right? Like, I don't know anything really. Like, oh, creatine gummies, I think has been like the latest one where it's been like really controversial. But like you've been saying for ages, like those creatine gummies are a load of shit.
Yeah.
Or a whey is measured in the nitrogen that it gives off as it ferments or something. And like, that's not an accurate way of measuring whey. That's just you're measuring nitrogen. Yeah. Like you've effectively applied PICO to that. Yeah. Well, who are the people saying that it's full of whey or the companies that own them?
Yeah.
Oh, so it benefits them. Yeah. Well, like that. But people don't understand how to do that because there's so few people calling that misinformation out. We don't know how to critically think. We don't know how to critically analyze information. So people see something that agrees with their bias and just go, oh, I'm going to repost that. And now, and particularly then if you're in a position of influence and power within the veteran community, more people are going to believe that. But you go, but that's not true. Or that's not what that legislation says. It's like being the barrack room barrister. You know, someone who's like convinced they know the legal processes for everything. Yeah. Oh, actually, the army can't make you do that. It's not legal. If I mean, the army makes you do whatever the fuck it wants you to do. Like,
real world.
You do as you're told, bro. If it's underneath your beret, it's not against army regulations. They can't shave it off. Yeah. And then they're getting pinned to the floor and having their head shaved. Yeah.
But Queensberg says,
shut up. Right. So like, it's about learning. The biggest misconceptions we need to, one of the biggest things we need to change is learn to apply the same skepticism to things you agree with, to the same things you disagree with. And like learning to that, one of the best things that people can do, because people simply don't do this enough. People don't read. I'm not saying they can't read. I'm saying they don't read. And like, it doesn't have to be self-help books and it doesn't have to be stoicism and it doesn't have to be like science. It can also just be stories. Like why are less young men reading Lord of the Rings? Like these are like really powerful stories. Like that's like how we started talking about the power of stories. Like we glamorize war, but power of stories and heroism and love and loss. Like the things as human beings we find so inspiring, but people don't read because if it doesn't fit on a 6-second reel or if it's not like brain dead entertainment, like people don't tend to watch it and absorb it and identify it and like look at things like underlying themes and what they're actually trying to say and what that actually looks like. Like explaining to someone that the fairy tale creatures in Shrek are a representation of the LGBTQ community and they're all in interracial relationships and there's even a transvestite wolf.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, I've never seen it like that. Yeah. And you're like, because you don't read, because we don't teach critical thinking anymore. Yeah. And I think so many problems in the modern world would be solved if people could, someone could stand up and say something and people go, I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
Or like someone could say something in a podcast just because it's on a, and you're like, maybe we need to look at that. I'm not sure that I agree with that. I need to look at the data. If people could just apply those simplicities of how to analyze information, like just, I think so much anger and so much resentment and so much like us versus them would just be removed because you'd be like, that's not true.
Yeah.
So that, cool.
We've got one more thing for you, Jimmy.
Go on.
We know you like our cups. So
love them.
Here's a new one for you to try.
So much, I'm excited.
On camera, so this is going to be like, you know, Jimmy didn't know he was getting these. It's a white chocolate caramelized biscuit. It's Biscoff, not Biscoff, because we're not allowed to say that. And hopefully he does that. I want to put my feet in as well. So if he doesn't like them, hopefully he won't spit them at me.
Okay, here we go.
Here we go.
Fucking hell, mate. That's so that's a lot of protein in that as well. That's 10 grams, and because there's two, because I'm going to have them both, that's 20 grams of protein in there.
So he's, there we go. Look at that.
Oh my God. These are wonderful.
Magic.
Oh my God.
Magic.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for having me.
Mate, you're very welcome. Jimmy, thank you for coming and sharing your story, catching a mouthful of food. Thank you for your service. Thank you for coming over.
Cheers, bro.